This podcast is a proud member of the LAM Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Welcome to the premiere episode of TV Good, Sleep Bad, the podcast which stays up way past its bedtime to celebrate cool TV and obsess over those obscure shows most people have forgotten, often with good reason. I'm your host, well, one half of your host. My name is Edward Jones from the Depths of DVD Hell and Channel Superhero, and my co-host for this jaunt into bizarre and most likely random cool TV, it gives me great pleasure to introduce my co-host, Lackey.
Hello!
First off, Lackey, thank you very much for agreeing to join me on what's probably going to be a very random show, to say the least.
Oh, I never get tired of being random.
Obviously, some people may remember that we did some episodes together over my other show, the Mad, Bad, and Downright Strange Showcase, where we were drafting under-the-radar movies as well as looking at some obscure cinema. This time, we're doing a show together. This is all exciting new territory, because I don't think there is any other podcast out there which looks at just random cult TV. They either have they normally have a show and they go for it from episode 1 through to episode 170 or whatever it got up to. So while it would have been nice to obviously focus on one show, I have a feeling that we would have ended up with at least 20 podcasts trying to do it once. So what we've decided instead is that we're going to each pick an episode each episode, and we're going to choose an episode of a show and challenge each other to basically watch said episode. So, I mean, do you want to start by showing what episode you've decided to choose for this premiere episode?
For the premiere episode, I have chosen the second season premiere of the original Outer Limits show, the black and white version from the 60s, not the Showtime revival. Like I said, it's the second season premiere, broadcast originally 1964, and written by legendary science fiction author Harlan Ellison. The name of the episode is Soldier.
Cool. For myself, I've decided to go with the Tetsuburo production, Ultra Q, obscure little Japanese show featuring giant monsters, and which would lead in to the likes of Ultraman and Ultra 7. We're going to be looking at the first episode of the show, Defeat Gomez. So we've got some giant monster action. We've got some sci-fi action happening on tonight's show. It's hopefully going to be a fun show. But before we obviously get into those episodes tonight, let's have a look at what we've obviously been holding our attention this week. Lackey, what shows have been holding your attention?
Predictably, if you've been listening to anything I've been saying about television on other podcasts, or if you've been reading my site, The Nightmare Gallery, you know I'm a huge fan of Hannibal, the sort of prequel/remix series based on Red Dragon and its follow-up novels. And it is winding down its third and, unfortunately, looks like it's going to be its last season right now. The penultimate episode of the season will air tomorrow over here. This season of Hannibal has not been... it's still very good. It had a little bit of a slow build. It took a few episodes to, I think, really kind of catch up and get to a good pace. But I'm liking where it's going now. And particularly the last few episodes, we are in the midst of a retelling of the Red Dragon story featuring Richard Armitage as Dollarhide, and he's doing a fantastic job. So Hannibal, as always, and I'm also on a bit of an animation binge. One of the recent podcasts I had done a couple months ago was another TV special, was for the Lamcast, and the host of that, Robert Zerbe of Escape Hatch, sang the praises of Rick and Morty, which is a more adult-oriented cartoon. I think it's an Adult Swim production about an alcoholic and occasionally drug-addled mad scientist and his feckless grandson having adventures across the multiverse. That's an interesting show, let me tell you. And also Archer, which is a sort of a cross between a postmodern spy story and a workplace comedy. And just a brilliant show there.
It seems that Zobby seems to be on the sort of quest to get us all watching his, it would seem to be his favorite show of all time. I've watched about 5 minutes of the first episode, and I was like, this is really weird for something that's on Cartoon Network.
They have, it's part of the Adult Swim block, which I always like to describe as shows for stoners to watch in the middle of the night. That's also part of the same block, I think, whatever they're calling, what is that thing? Aqua Teen Hunger Force. Whatever that show's called now. I know it changed titles a few times. But, yeah, and it's part of that block. So it's got a similar kind of, like, I guess, aesthetic, I guess you'd say.
Yeah. I keep meaning to watch more of it. I think the last thing I watched from Adult Swim was Frisky Dingo. Which, again, is another show that no one ever seems to remember. So I feel that we will be looking at it on a future episode.
Yeah, it sounds perfect for this kind of project.
So, just in terms of cartoons, I'm totally still obsessed with Gravity Falls. I think it surprises me just how dark that show is getting, especially for a show that's being shown primarily on Disney, and not like in an Adult Swim sort of block. This is like during the day, and it's constantly surprising me the things they're getting away with, such as the creepy uncle saying, "Who wants to wear blindfolds in the car?"
Oh, God.
We had a scene where they find out there's little gnome people that run the miniature golf course.
Wow.
And in each hole it shows as the ball goes down, it like they move the different things around. So it goes in the little mine cart one, and it's like, oh, I wonder what sort of antics are down there. And it's like, we got gas in the hole. And it shows like this big gnome just like pushing it through before dying of gas poisoning at the end.
Wow. That kind of thing where it looks like it's straight up for kids, but it's a lot darker, that seems to be something of a trend. I think Adventure Time kind of has that as well, which is geared a little bit towards younger audiences.
I'm still trying to figure out what's supposed to be happening in Adventure Time. I no idea. Every time I try and like make head or tail, I cannot figure out what's going on in Adventure Time.
Yeah, that's just... I like weird, but in some ways Adventure Time is just too weird for me.
I mean, do you think that this sort of combination of sort of adult humor within kids' shows is a lot to do with The Simpsons?
I think The Simpsons may very well have something to do with it. I don't think it's the only... I don't really know. I generally don't watch a whole lot of animation as it stands, actually. My current obsession with... Rick and Morty and Archer is actually somewhat anomalous for me. The last time I really watched cartoons on a regular basis was when the Powerpuff Girls were at the peak of their popularity.
You're just making me feel old now remembering Powerpuff Girls, because that was what?
Late 90s and early 2000s, and I want to point this out here. I think I'm older than you are. So I was watching Powerpuff Girls in my mid to late 20s. I want to point out right up front, I did not watch it as a kid. So making that reference, I feel about as old as you do. But it's certainly, I think, I don't know. It's The Simpsons has certainly been a sort of kind of like a titan over all the current animation. But I think there may be a lot of other things in there, other influences like... along with The Simpsons, one of the very first cartoons I remember watching that had, you know, both a level for kids and a level for adults was Ren and Stimpy. And Ren and Stimpy was very influential.
Oh, Ren and Stimpy, for myself, it always seemed to be funny, and then it would push it too far.
Right.
But, I mean, with Ren and Stimpy, you have a show where the creator is actually making a show just for the amusement of himself and his friends, and he was unfortunately towards the later seasons he was in the unfortunate position of having his show taken away from him.
Right.
Yeah, Ren and Stimpy, I always used to find just like it just used to go really disgusting.
Right.
And it's probably why I gravitated more towards Rocko's Modern Life, which was kind of like the lighter version of Ren and Stimpy.
Uh huh.
It's also fun just the amount of these shows that are now suddenly randomly appearing like on Amazon Prime. Like, I just stumbled across Our Real Monsters, which again is another show I've not watched in years.
Right.
But they've got the whole block on there.
I remember that one.
Obviously, outside of obsessing over cartoons, the show which has really sort of caught my interest recently would be Banshee, which just recently wrapped up its latest season. If you've not seen the show, it's basically about this tale of this thief called Hood, who, having got out of prison, he hiding out in the town of Banshee, and through a number of circumstances ends up disguising himself as the town sheriff, only to find out that the town, while it's maybe sleeping on the surface, is actually a hotbed of all kinds of criminal activity, as the local Amish crime boss is in conflict with the local Native Americans. This is a show that just constantly gets better and better each season that they produce, and it's nice that here we have a badass who does bad things to bad people, and that seems to be just the whole theme of the show, and it constantly finds new and inventive ways to up the violence and craziness that they cram in there. But it's nice to have a show that's got decent writing but isn't feeling it's got to dumb it down, at the same time not feeling it has to overcomplicate itself, which seems to be the curse with so many shows basically since The Wire made money. A lot of shows have been trying to imitate it and being over complex, and I think that's why I've struggled to get into Hannibal. I found that they could have shot it a lot more straightforward, but instead they've gone for this very Lynch-esque style, which is probably why I put off watching the last season. It's stacked up on the DVR, but I keep like thinking, this is going to be something I'm going to need to focus on. It's not something I can casually watch.
Yeah, and this is the third season, really. Even I'm to the point where I started to get a little bit, you know, irritated with, okay, can you just maybe... Yeah, it's nice to have all this teacup imagery and people turning into stag, raven, man things and blood and, you know, Gillian Anderson drowning in a tub, but can you just get on with the story?
Yes.
Yet, it really, with the first few episodes of the season, it really, Fuller really pulls back the reins on the pacing. And it's not that I don't, like I said, it's not that I don't like the episodes, but kind of they're catch-up and thematic episodes more than, like, plot-driving-forward episodes. And there's really only so much of that I can take.
And obviously, with the show being cancelled prematurely, do you feel that this is, in a way, affected this final season? That Fuller's trying to find a way to bring it to a conclusion that's going to mean that it's not sort of hanging there in the air, such as his other shows, such as Wonderfalls and Dead Like Me, which both kind of got cut off in their prime and never had that final episode. And it perhaps feels that he's trying to avoid that with Hannibal, that he's trying to leave it at a place where we can then pick up with the films and go on from there.
I definitely think he saw the writing on the wall. I think a lot of people were shocked when it got picked up for the third season. I know I was surprised. And you can definitely tell, you know, back in the beginning, when Hannibal first debuted and he was interviewed for his plans, he had a whole like 7-season plan lined up for Hannibal, where the way he would discuss it is that, you know, covering the Hannibal novel would take an entire season, covering the Red Dragon novel would take an entire season, and the first half of the season, the current season, is basically kind of like a remix of Hannibal, the events from the novel Hannibal.
Yeah.
And the second half is Red Dragon. And I definitely think he understood that he was running out of time. I think it was more the threat of cancellation than the cancellation itself. I would not be surprised if he went into planning the third season the way Whedon is said to have gone in planning a lot of the season finales for Buffy, the earlier ones where it, you know, didn't look like it was going to be renewed from season to season, and designing the season finales so that they could stand alone as series finales if they needed to.
Oh, he definitely certainly did design each season so that it would provide an endpoint. This is something I've obviously recently discovered, because we are, at the moment, over in Channel Superhero. We are currently revisiting the whole of Buffy. We just started season 2, which for many people is really where the show really started to get going. It had the advantage of being a 22-episode season compared to the previous season's 13. And finally had a half-decent villain, because I don't know your thoughts, Lucky, but for myself, the Master always seemed kind of half-baked. He was sort of like, he worked more when he was like this mythological figure, when he did these little appearances like on Angel, or when they were doing like the more backstory pieces for Angel on Buffy. He worked better then, but as the main villain of the first season, I never felt he was any sort of real threat. He was sort of trapped in his little sewer lair and kind of just did nothing, really. The more interesting episodes in the first season were always the Creature of the Week ones, such as the robot demon or the puppet. Whenever it got onto like, oh, this is what the Master's plan this week, yeah, I just kind of lost interest. Which is obviously when we get into season two, and we get the introduction of Spike and Drusilla, and we get to see Bad Angel. It just all seemed to come together, and that the show was trying to correct a lot of these mistakes. And the most evident part was when they get rid of the Anointed One, probably the most pointless character who'd served his purpose in season one, yet somehow turns up in season two. I mean, were you a Buffy fan going through?
I actually have only seen a few Buffy episodes. I've never really sought out the entire show. I've seen an episode here or there, but I have a number of friends. I have a number of friends who are Buffy fans, very, very big Buffy fans, and the consensus seems to be that really the show really starts to get good within the second season. Which happens quite a bit, I think, with series. It kind of takes a while for a show to figure out what it's going to do well, and you know how for the actors to fit into, kind of grow into the roles. And Fringe is a really good example where it started off as kind of like an X-Files clone, and then became something completely different.
Fringe is another series cut short in its prime. The final season, I think, was especially evident to that. Just the fact that here you had a show where you had basically then. You were trying to cram in the whole of the what would have been another couple of seasons worth into a final season. So we had that horrible jarring moment where it suddenly jumped forward in time.
Yeah.
And he was sort of like, oh yeah, this happened. And it felt like the second season of Dollhouse, where you could tell that, okay, we need to wrap this up. So we're going to just jump ahead in time. And it really killed the series. Like any interest I had in that series was just killed dead. But Fringe somehow managed to maintain the interest up into the end, even though it perhaps wasn't the ending we all wanted.
Yeah, Fringe is one of those where I was a huge fan of Fringe, and I still am, and even to the point where I certainly don't think the fifth series is the epitome of what the show did well, but it still had a lot of moments I really liked. It didn't kill my interest in the show. But it was getting kind of clear, I think, at that moment. Number one, again, the ratings. The ratings were just not enough to sustain the show. And a wrap-up did need to provide a wrap-up. And number two, I think they were just kind of running out of ideas. You know, I mean, 100 episodes, 5 seasons is a fairly long time for a show to go on. You know, particularly with the same creative vision behind the camera. So, I don't know. I certainly... With Fringe, I certainly think that it kind of ended at a good point, as opposed to going on for a couple more extraneous seasons like the X-Files did.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a point where the X-Files had finished, but for some reason they felt that they had to overcomplex it. And by the end, we had the whole conspiracy plot, and it was just more of a confused mess than it really needed to be.
Right.
I mean, is there any other sort of shows that have been holding your interest? Has it just really been a Hannibal obsession?
It's been Hannibal obsession recently. Let's see, the other two shows I've been doing quite a bit. I'm done with them for the time being, but I finished recently. I just finished up Black Christmas, Black Mirror. Finally got around to the last year's Christmas special with Jon Hamm and Rafe Spall. And I'm also going through Inside Number 9.
Okay.
We have the first series of Inside Number 9 here on Amazon. And I really, really, I'm something of a, not a huge fan, but I'm a bit of a fan of League of Gentlemen and Psychoville. And I've always liked kind of like the aesthetic that they bring. They have this very kind of gothic, almost like a Hammer style aesthetic and a sense of irony that I've always appreciated, and I'm really enjoying Inside Number 9.
I should also explain to our listeners that, as you will probably learn on future episodes, that Lackey is unashamedly an Anglophile, am I right in saying?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Whereas myself, being the one who lives in England, tends to watch more American shows, which, while obviously if you're an American or someone from outside the UK and you appreciate British culture, you get that wonderful sexy word, Anglophile. If you're a Brit who appreciates like American culture or culture outside your own, we have a less sexy word. It's called traitor.
I was thinking you were going to say anorak for a moment there. Well, I mean, part of it is I think it's just that we spam other countries so much with our culture. I think it's just kind of impossible to live in other countries and not kind of just get have all this stuff rained down on you.
For myself, it's the quality of writing and production that when it comes to the American shows, and I know that, again, this has a lot to do with these powerhouses like HBO, Showtime, Max, who are churning out these great shows. And when I look at the shows which obviously hold my interest, they're all American shows. For some reason, the British, when with the British production houses, and have been exceptions such as Channel 4's Humans, which have obviously bucked this trend. But when we look at the BBC, which most embarrassingly we have to pay for, even if you're not watching it, we still have to pay for it. And they
license
produce
fee.
Dreck. And they hide it under this charming little way where they say, oh, the unique way we're funded. So the way where basically, you give us money or we fine you.
It's a shakedown.
Yeah, it's basically you have to pay for these channels you're not watching.
Yeah, actually, now that I think about it, I think most of the shows I do watch actually are most of the British shows I watch are I don't remember if Inside Number 9 is BBC. I know Black Mirror isn't.
Black Mirror is,
Channel 4? Yeah. And there's a couple of shows, obviously. Another thing that anybody knows who knows anything about me knows, I'm a gigantic Doctor Who fan, mostly the 60s and 70s. But I do keep up with the current series. I know that's BBC, and the other show that I watch that's BBC that I watch a lot of is, this is the one that completely shocks people who know my tastes. I'm a huge fan of Call the Midwife.
Yeah. Okay. I understand there are shows that you have like that neutral grounds that you may watch with like your partner and stuff. For myself, I'm currently watching with my wife the show Unreal, which is basically a drama series about the behind-the-scenes making of a show like The Bachelor, but okay. It's basically focusing on how everything's falling apart with this production team and how they manipulate the different cast members to make the show play how they want it to. And that's the show I'm watching with my wife, and we also watch things like Most Next Top Model. Call the Midwife? This is another thing like, oh, what's the show? Downton Abbey.
What I say about Downton Abbey is I liked it a lot more the first time I saw it when it was called Upstairs, Downstairs.
It's the original version. I have to break it to you because in the States, Downton Abbey is seen as like this hip show. Over here in Britain, it's a show for the older generation, should we say.
That does not surprise me.
But I know there's a number of people probably out there who seem to think that this is a documentary on British life. That we've all got servants and we live in stately homes, just longing for a bungalow.
Yeah, that's kind of what we would call over here, what we would call lifestyle porn. You know, it's this sort of thing. It's like, yeah, this is how people actually live. This is like the status quo for people. This is a wonderful little story. How I got into the Call the Midwife is my mother.
All right.
My mother started watching it, and this is bizarre because my mother will not generally watch anything where anybody has an accent that isn't completely neutral American Midwest. And I started watching it with her and kind of answering her questions. You know, it's like, oh, and I would, you know, it's just the sort of thing where I have to, you know, I get to, you know, pause the Blu-ray player every so often and tell her things like, see, in Britain, they have a class, or had, and they still have it, although they don't really, although things are changing a lot, a codified class system, which we also have in America, but we pretend we don't have it. You know?
Yeah.
So I got to kind of go from there to explaining the great Ronnie Barker, Ronnie Corbett, John Cleese class system, using that particular classic sketch from the 60s. You know, so it's like, that's why people are like this. Yes, there really kind of was a third world country in the middle of London back then.
I can't believe that you actually used the class system sketch to explain.
It's a simplified, you know, way. It's an easier way of getting it across.
Yeah. Well, we'll put it on the Facebook page, and then if people want to check it out, can obviously have a look at how Lackey explains the class system.
Yeah, how Lackey, a person who has spent all of 2 weeks in Britain, explains their entire society.
There we go.
please catch me next week on my new show, Lackey Explains It All. Next week, class privilege.
Hey, if we can give Morgan Spurlock's Guide to Britain... Which is always great.
Is there actually a Morgan Spurlock's Guide to Britain?
Oh, yeah.
You poor people.
And they didn't get this right. An American is going to come over here and explain our society to us.
My God. I mean, dear God, you'd get better having Carl Pilkington do that. Oh, my God. He's the last person. Oh, my God. I'm sorry. I'm going to have a heart attack now.
Yeah, watching Morgan Spurlock try to get his head around black pudding is just endlessly amusing, though. So.
Oh, boy. Well, that's Americans for you. We always do like to pretend we know other people better than we know ourselves. And actually better than we know ourselves.
Fair enough. I mean, before we obviously start a new civil war, we might as well just move on to the first of tonight's episode selections.
Yes. Before we do anything, before we actually start war with each other, let's declare war on Japan.
Okay. First off, we're going to start with Ultra Q. We're looking at episode one of the 26th season that would prove to be the only season for the show, sadly. The episode's title was called Defeat Gomez. The show itself, as we said before, it was produced by Tsuburaya, who, if you're a Godzilla fan or just a fan of kaiju movies in general, will be a name that you'll be instantly familiar with, as here we have a man whose importance in the kaiju community is essentially the same as what Stan Winston was to Creature Effects. You can go through the who's who of giant monsters, and you can pretty much guarantee that he had some sort of work on there. This is a man who not only gave us Godzilla, but also would go on to work on Rodan and Mothra before starting work on Ultra Q, which he envisioned as a kind of Outer Limits style show, where each story is essentially a standalone episode, but happens to feature different giant monsters. For the most part, there are a few episodes which choose to buck this trend. The show itself, as I said, it's if you like Godzilla movies, you will be very much at home here. The episode itself, seeing one of the original Godzilla suits, a suit used in Godzilla vs. the Thing, and Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster being reutilized, should we say, for this episode, to play the titular Monster Gomez. Opening thoughts on this one, Lackey. What did you think of this one as a first-time viewer of Ultra Q?
Well, I misheard the title of the episode. I thought it was Defeat Gomez. I thought they were going to go after the woman who played the Missy in the most recent series of Doctor Who. But all joking aside, this was also, I really like how the Wikipedia article on Ultra Q compares it to the X-Files.
Yeah, because I had, you know, strange monsters. We got this team investigating. Because here we've obviously got the aviator sort of character, and we've also got the reporter style character, which I guess was the only way they can compare it, the fact that we have this team investigating strange monsters and phenomena in Japan. I personally lean more towards the Outer Limits than the X-Files, but, you know, whatever sparks your interest, I guess.
Whatever, yeah, whatever I think, whatever works. It's definitely, it's an interesting little episode. I'm not humongously familiar with like kaiju. I've seen a few movies here and there. I've seen a couple Godzilla movies. I've seen, you know, Pacific Rim. You can prepare to stone me for that one.
No. Pacific Rim, wonderful.
I've seen the MST3K parodies of the Gamera movies. I've seen the South Park episode with Robert Smith where he plays Mothra and goes against Micah Streisand. That's about as far as it goes. And it's a fun little episode. It does kind of have this thing where it is simply marking time before the big showdown between Gomez and, is it Lytra? Which is this very, very adorable little lizard bird thing that hatches about halfway through the episode and just kind of like just sits around for about half the episode, just kind of staring. And what I really appreciate is the kid. I hope the kid's in every episode of this because he's this sort of little, you know, typical nerdy kid with these huge glasses, which I did not actually believe anybody ever actually wore in Japan. I just thought that they were part of like a stereotype, but no, apparently they had this gigantic round rimmed glasses that would take up half your face and had really thick lenses. And he's the one who figures everything out. He's the one, you know, he takes a couple of little bits of like disparate information, like the one guy, he says he's seen something. They got, you know, the premise being, you know, some people are, you know, this company's digging a tunnel from Tokyo to, I think, Osaka.
Yeah.
And they come up with some, you know, weird anomalous stuff in there, and they come up with this big thing that they think is a meteor or maybe a geode, but it turns out to be an egg. And they go and they rush off to a temple to confirm that. And then this kid becomes absolutely convinced that this is like, there's this like creature that's been incubating in this egg for millions of years and it hatches. And this is the only way Gomez, who's menacing the reporter and another character down in the caves where they're trapped. And, you know, this is the only, and he keeps trying to, keeps trying to talk the Lytra into like going down there and fighting Gomez. And I just love that because it's like, it's total kid logic. Here is an egg that's been buried in the earth for millions of years. It's just hatched. And oh, definitely, you know, number one, the bird's going to understand your commands in Japanese. It knows its name. It knows that there's something down there it's supposed to fight. And having just newly hatched, it's totally in a condition to take on Godzilla.
Yeah, essentially what we've got here is, as I said, with the recycling for Gomez, the recycling in an old Godzilla suit. Again, they would do this again with Ultraman, where they basically put a spitter collar on Godzilla and repainted it. So Toho was really kind of notorious for recycling their monster costumes wherever possible. And here with Gomez, they basically take the Godzilla costume and add these little appendages so it kind of looks like a walrus version of Godzilla.
Good Lord, you're right. I hadn't thought about that.
And as you said, the setup for the story is so simple. Basically, they're just digging for the tunnel. They tick off Gomez, and who basically sets about trashing everything. And we've got the little bit of tenseness where we've got our two heroes and they're stuck in the cavern. Again, we've got Lytra, who we're waiting to hatch from the egg just to basically have the big showdown with Gomez and save our heroes, essentially. It's just all about the setup to the big monster fight.
Uh-huh.
And they really sort of cram a lot into a 25-minute episode, which is really what surprised me. I thought the episodes were a lot longer, but it is only 25 minutes, and it goes at such a pace. You never really feel that it's dragging in a
right
sort of place.
I do have to say, for the recycling, and we're going to get into some proper cycling, I don't think in the next episode, in the Outer Limits episode, but Outer Limits and let's just say Outer Limits and Star Trek shared prop department. But I really actually thought they did a great model work with the big fight towards the end of the Ultra Q episode, where it was like they really did a very good job, I think, of scaling down the location into a model and making it look as realistic as you can possibly get when you've got two people in gigantic monster suits running around, you know, beating each other up.
And it's, again, it would be if they were two sort of men in monster suits, then it would be a little easier, should we say. But Lystra, again, is basically a demented eagle-looking thing, which is difficult enough to try and pull off some sort of convincing life and death battle.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with like a Godzilla suit. I mean, we only have to look at the film such as any film which sort of featured Godzilla taking on Rodan or Mothra. It was always kind of clumsy when you've got these sort of winged monsters trying to take on a ground monster. Mm-hmm. Whereas obviously King Ghidorah had the size and it looked imposing enough when it was standing on the ground, so it was able to sort of get around that. But
right.
Yeah, this is, I mean, while this show obviously only ran for about 26 episodes, it paved the way for like Ultraman and Ultra 7 and essentially everything that followed it. And there's this really touching story that Tetsubaru was overheard two school children talking about the episode, and they were proclaiming how great it was that they could watch giant monsters fight every week. And he felt like this glow of satisfaction from what he had created.
Uh-huh.
And that was basically all he wanted to do, was just create a giant monster show, knowing that giant monsters were popular at the time, because they were in the middle of the Keiju boom. So he'd originally intended it for an older audience, but the fact that kids latched onto it, I think really, in a way, paved the way to the likes of Ultraman and the numerous spin-offs that were generating in its own. So
right.
But again, even if you're just watching this as a giant monster sort of show, it's still a lot of fun. It doesn't take itself too seriously. It sets up its own little mythos, which is easy to buy into. It's not like so outlandish that you have trouble getting into it. It's sort of like, oh, this is what this character does, this is what this one does, and then this is the final showdown.
Right. It's not, I mean, to the extent that, again, you're watching a show about gigantic monsters, you know, knocking chunks out of each other, you know, for a family show, its types are very much grounded in, I don't know if I want to say reality, but enough of kind of like a simplistic kind of view of the things you would, the sort of types that you would understand in a situation. And the characters are, for the most part, again, they're definitely types. There isn't really a whole lot of anything anybody would call character development in the episode, but it's got enough of the familiar that the fantastic elements, you can kind of believe the fantastic elements when they come in.
Yeah, just obviously, I mean, you obviously mentioned about the model work already. The thing I love about the model work, and again, this is really Tetsubaru's work really shining through, it's the attention to the small details when they have the fight outside the tunnel. And there's a little train truck there, and one of the monsters knocks it over, and you see the little pipes go out. I just love those little touches that are sort of scattered throughout it. There's a sense of reality, even though it's completely fantastical.
Right. And I noticed that as well. And particularly in comparison to some, you know, of the, like, you know, 70s and 60s, not 70s, 50s and 60s cheapy, like, B-movie things that came out of America that were made for, like, $1.95, and, you know, you would see, like, a fire truck get upended, and you would see on the bottom of it the name of the manufacturer that had manufactured the toy. You know, it had been bought right off the shelf at a toy store. There is kind of like a very... Ultra Q was made by people who were craftspeople and appreciated their craft and was made lovingly. You know, it's... I mean, definitely it was made to cash in on a popularity in giant monsters, but something that people, you know, they have, you can definitely tell a genuine affection in the craftsmanship of it. And it's these little touches, like right after the truck scene, I love Gomez's death scene where he kind of like sort of bounces down these like series of ridges down to like the bottom of this like construction pit. It's just one of those neat little touches.
And while in, especially to Western audiences, this show and like the Godzilla movies, they were so just sort of like B-movie fodder. Whereas obviously in Japan, the viewed were much higher status. I mean, I've mentioned on previous shows before that the honor of being asked to direct a Godzilla movie is viewed as this being the same level as being asked to direct a James Bond movie.
Right.
To Japanese directors. So, And it's nice the fact that they carry that across. So even though we're working on a smaller scale here, being obviously a TV format, the love that Chizuru brought to his larger scale projects like Rodan and Mothra and Godzilla, it's still very evident, as we said there. And the way it's all shot again from low angles. So you get the emphasis of height, even though this is essentially just a man in a monster costume. You never feel that, oh, I'm just watching a man in a monster costume just like break stuff.
Right.
It gives you that sort of escapism to go, okay, this is this giant monster and this is what he's doing. I mean, true, some of the later episodes, such as the second episode where they basically, again, they recycle one of the King Kong suits from King Kong versus Godzilla. It's kind of less easy to get into that sort of level of escapism, mainly because the monkey costume just always looked awful. And it would have been nice for them to use a better costume, but they never did.
The King Kong. I hated the King Kong costume from Godzilla vs. King Kong. God, I hated it.
And they never even changed it for when they did the sequel, either.
Ugh.
Because obviously when we did King Kong Escapes, I think Mecha Kong was a better costume than they had for the King Kong costume they used.
Wow.
But,
wow.
Yeah, obviously, if you are wanting to watch the show, it is available, especially if you're in the US, you can stream it directly through Shout Factory, who put out the DVD series. If you go to shoutfactory.tv, the show is available to view online there, and it's complete in its entirety. There's also a number of other great shows on there as well, such as The Time Tunnel and Outer Limits, both available to view at your convenience there. So if it does sound like a show that's interesting you and you don't want to take a gamble on the box set, then you can certainly watch a few episodes online at shoutfactory.tv as well. Anything else that you want to obviously bring up about this one, Lucky?
I think that's about it.
And so certainly, if you are a fan of the Godzilla movies, this is really great companion piece, especially as well if you liked shows such as Ultraman. There is so much to enjoy here. It's, as I said, it is just giant monster action within that sort of X-Files sort of twist, and maybe more shot from really sort of with the lens of the Outer Limits. But each week you get a different giant monster, and there's 26 episodes shot in beautiful black and white as well, which is just kind of welcome, especially when you're looking at films, shows from this sort of era. Have shows in color, they tend to be a little fuzzy, but the black and white transfer that they have for this is absolutely stunning, so well worth checking out. So on that note, we're just going to take a quick break, but when we return, we'll be looking at the second episode selection for this evening, which is The Outer Limits Soldier.
Listen to The Lair of the Unwanted on iTunes, and you can hear me, Jason Soto, use the F word.
French?
No.
Fudge?
Sorta, but no.
Frank?
No.
Fridge?
No.
Faruka Balk?
What? No.
Farfid Nugan?
Jeez, no.
Alright, what F-word could you possibly be talking about?
I'm talking about
In the Lair of the Unwanted, covering the movies you don't want to see and more, on iTunes.
Still with me is my co-host, as always, Lucky.
Hello.
In the first half, we obviously looked at the episode 1 of Ultra Q, Defeat Gomez. For our second episode we're looking at this evening, I'm going to pass it now over to Lucky, who's going to introduce his episode selection.
My selection is the second season premiere of the original Outer Limits, Soldier. This was the original Outer Limits, the black and white series, ran from 1963, 1964, and I think into 1965. This was, the Outer Limits is kind of seen as, kind of cut from the same cloth as Twilight Zone. It's a black and white anthology series. Unlike the Twilight Zone, the episodes, it's just an hour-long format, and whereas the Twilight Zone tended to be a little bit more of a, take a little bit more of a humanistic, moralistic fable, most of the episodes of the Outer Limits are pretty solidly science fiction or science fiction horror with a bit of a modernist or postmodernist bent. Almost more of it like an experimental series as well. The creator of The Outer Limits was Leslie Stevens, who, if I remember correctly, in 1966 or 1967, made only the second mainstream film where all the dialogue was in Esperanto. That was called Incubus, starring William Shatner. Most of the first season is a little bit more horror-oriented. The showrunner for the first season, Joseph Stefano, stepped down, and for the second season, Ben Brady took over, and Ben Brady's pursued more of, like I said, a more straight-up science fiction, even going so far as to produce an adaptation of Isaac Asimov's classic short story, I, Robot. Soldier is one of two episodes scripted by a then up-and-coming, now legendary, science fiction author named Harlan Ellison, also known as one of the great curmudgeons, I guess, of our time. One of the things that most people who have heard of Soldier know about it was that Harlan Ellison sued Orion Pictures and Hemdale, the producers and distributors of The Terminator, for plagiarism, to which the party settled a lawsuit, and the producers put a little blurb at the end of the film crediting Harlan Ellison's influence. The premise of Soldier is this. 1800 years in the future, there's some sort of war going on in some sort of post-apocalyptic wasteland that looks like it was out of a German expressionist film. And random energy beam zaps these two foot soldiers. And that hurls them into a time vortex. One of them is sort of caught in time, and the other one is transported to contemporary United States, contemporary for the time. So he finds himself in an anonymous United States city in the year 1964, where running around in what looks like futuristic version of chainmail and helm, and a threatening-looking zap gun, he is apprehended by the police. Nobody can really kind of understand what he says. He keeps saying one thing over and over, and nobody can figure out what it means, what its significance is. The police and the FBI bring in a language expert named Tom Kagan to talk to him and see if what he can make out, and it basically turns out that the thing this soldier is saying over and over again, he's saying his name, his rank, and his serial, well, not serial numbers, but serial code, which is what you'd do if you were a POW in this situation. And the episode goes on to kind of like develops the relationship between Kagan and the soldier, Quarlo Klebregny, and kind of how they kind of learn to, you know, how Tom Kagan kind of learns to communicate with Quarlo, how they, you know, basically kind of learn to kind of trust each other, and then, you know, going through your standard kind of, you know, up and down plot beats to the conclusion. The episode, a lot of the themes in the episode are going to be fairly familiar to anybody with much knowledge of science fiction of this era. And you can definitely see, you know, the influence of these ideas in later science fiction, particularly the idea that Quarlo and his unnamed enemy have been trained from birth to be soldiers and don't understand really anything other than aggression and fighting. So I am going to turn it over to you, Ed Elwood.
Yeah, this is when it comes to the Outer Limits. I'm more familiar with the revamped series, which ran from 1995 to 2002. That was my entry point for the Outer Limits, and I think it's safe to say that the wanting to revisit these old episodes of the Outer Limits and the Twilight Zone were really what inspired us to do the show. That and a recent blog film being hosted by essentially the linchpin of the LAM, the Last Movie Blogs Association, Bubba Wee, over at his site Channel Superhero. He's hosting a blogathon for Tales from the Crypt. And again, it was another anthology show which I missed out on the first time around. So the fact that you've chosen The Outer Limits straight off as one of our first episodes to discuss, I was very happy about. As you said already, that this episode was a big influence for The Terminator. This and Demon with the Glass Hand, which is probably the more well-known of the two episodes. But right from the start, you can see a lot of startling similarities between this and Terminator. The desolate wasteland, the random laser beams, and the fact that these two, this idea that you have these killing machines, that essentially we have the soldier of the peace, and the fact he's been reconditioned into society. And it brought up those scenes in, especially in Terminator 2, where we have the young John O'Connor trying to recondition the Terminator to be more human. That's what I kept thinking of when I was watching the scenes where he's like trying to teach him humanity, and he's showing him the little clip reel, mm-hmm. and trying to explain what humanity is. Because as you said, that here we have soldiers that are trained from birth, and the fact that they wear the little headsets that just constantly tell them to seek out their enemy. And
seek the enemy. Kill.
Which
kill.
It's really creepy.
Brilliant. By the way, I want to cut in and just say for really quickly, brilliant vocal performance there by the two actors, uncredited, who are doing those voices, just repeating those phrases. Tim O'Connor and Vic Perrin. Vic Perrin also is the control voice, the narrator who opens and closes every episode of The Outer Limits.
The only, obviously, gripe I have with this episode is that we obviously have our soldiers thrown into time, and we constantly have the flashbacks to the second soldier who's sort of like phased in halfway, and he seems to still be on his original timeline, yet when he fully phases in, he's on the same timeline as our main, as Qualo appears to be, which I didn't quite understand, how he could have obviously appeared to be still in the future, yet ends up on the same timeline as Qualo.
That is kind of weird, and I liked the effect that they used for him being caught in time, where they basically superimpose it so that it looks like he's kind of like a giant sort of disappearing into the post-apocalyptic landscape. But the thing about that is that he doesn't really actually make it to the contemporary time period until really almost the very end of the episode. And it's just like at the end of like every act, right before the commercial break, there's the obligatory picture of him just holding his gun and just like struggling. And it just seems like too many scenes of that.
Yeah, and there's a scene later in the episode where Qualo breaks into a gun store, because basically he's had all his equipment taken off, even though they bizarrely keep his body armor on him when he's being kept in the asylum, which I didn't understand. They take all his other equipment away from him, but they let him keep his body armor.
Yeah.
They never feel the urge to sort of strip him down and put him into like a sort of straight jacket or something that you would expect for someone who, by all accounts, is just batshit insane.
Right. His all of a sudden freak out and goes to basically, you know, break into a gun store and steal a gun seems to come almost out of nowhere. Because, you know, Tom Kagan basically convinces the powers that be, you know, it's like, I'm making progress with Qualo, I'm going to take him home, let me take him home and have him live with my family, and we can kind of teach him what, like, a normal, you know, family, yeah. How we kind of relate with each other, and which, you know, it's that's kind of a batshit idea to begin with, you know, but I can kind of accept it. But the thing is about that is that everything seems to be kind of going fine, and just after the next commercial break, oh my God, Qualo's broken into a gun store, and I thought it was the other soldier initially.
Yeah, exactly.
Because how are you going to tell these people? I mean, this I'm not really kind of being too, I guess, sarcastic when I compare the body armor to like medieval. I mean, it really does in the close-ups. It really does look like it's made out of chain, some sort of primitive chainmail almost, and it is very disguising. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, if you had the two soldiers wearing the helmets and the body armor, how would you tell them apart?
Yeah.
So I kept waiting for this revelation. No, it's not Quarlo. Quarlo's at home. Must be the other guy.
And how did he get to the gun store? That's the other thing that confused me. He's got no real knowledge of the city he's in, and yet somehow he manages to find his way to a gun store, and let alone have this instant knowledge of what could only be considered from his viewpoint to be very primitive weaponry.
Right.
But no, we see him there and he's got the rifle, and the way it's set up, you would expect, oh, this is where they're going to introduce the other soldier. And it's going to be like, oh, wait, there's two of them. But instead, the second soldier, comes in very late in the episode. It's almost like an afterthought when he finally makes his appearance at the end of the episode.
Yeah.
Which indeed sets up a very important question, which I will put aside for the moment. But it was one of the things which sort of took me out of the episode. And I like the fact that you obviously have him sort of talking it down and trying to reason with him, trying to find that spark of humanity within him, even though he frequently proclaims that, you know, he's only about being bred for war. This killing is all he knows. But throughout the episode, he just continuously refuses to give up. He has this undeniable belief that every man, even if they are sort of born for war, it has this humanity in them. And it kind of, for you, kind of never sure whether he actually does make that breakthrough or not. I mean, did you have a sort of feeling of he had a breakthrough or not? Or
and I think the closing narration, you know, I think really kind of, I think Ellison kind of means for that to be, I think, somewhat left up in the air. Because even like the ending, you know, the ending narration where the control voice says, you know, did the soldier finally come to, you know, actually genuinely care about Kagan and his family, or was it just his instinct? You know, was that breakthrough ever really made? Did Quarlo ever really kind of learn to trust? And I think that kind of really is something that the viewer would have to superimpose their own beliefs on there, whether or not you believe that sort of thing is, you know, if that's inbred, if that's, or if it's something that's a natural thing that's there, or if it's something that can be learned and taught. Certainly, you know, the script stacks everything against Quarlo, even to the point where he, you know, talks about being, not having parents and being born in a hatchery, really.
Mm.
I mean, the state, as they say, of the future, the whoever it is, whatever block that Quarlo fights for, they have taken everything, literally every bit of nurture out of any potential nurturing out of this environment, and have trained Quarlo to be a soldier literally from birth, you know, to the point where, you know, he doesn't even genuinely have parents. He, you know, was grown in a lab.
Yeah, and there's no real reason given for why these two sides are fighting each other. They dress essentially identical to each other. It's very difficult to tell, being black and white, whether they're wearing different color uniforms or not. But here we have these two forces that essentially, they're breeding soldiers for war in sort of like this hatchery environment, that essentially you're creating this eternal war, because it's not like either side is ever going to run out of troopers, because they just constantly breed more troopers to continue fighting for them. But there's never any reason given for this conflict. It's just these two sides that are locked in this sort of eternal struggle.
And I think that's definitely, I definitely think that's deliberate on the part of Ellison and the production team on this, to make both sides look identical, to not give a reason for this war. This is a war that's always been going on, you know, a war that's been going on for so long that nobody knows why they've been fighting it. Nobody knows what the difference is, other than that's the enemy. The enemy, you kill the enemy. Why? Because, you know, one of the notes I have down here, and I think this is a really interesting thing if you look at it. When you're dealing with this particular era of science fiction, anytime you see, I guess, like a race or a species or some sort of group of people that have had individuality bred out of them, literally, you're looking at a metaphor in some way or another for communism. And if you even look kind of carefully and pick certain things out, the name, you know, the name that Quarlo gives as his last name, Klebregny, has a slight Soviet feel to it. When he talks about his family, you know, he says, the state is all. You know, I don't have parents, the state is all, which kind of goes along with the Marxist-Leninist idea of replacing God or religion with a worship, literal worship of the state, you know. And that's, you know, to kind of put him in this position, someone like that, using code words that kind of subtly put off or not so subtly, you know, depending on, you know, what, how you look at the episode, kind of say communism and have him talking, you know, and have him kind of as like the point of contact and not the other one, really kind of, I think, in to an extent, either consciously or subconsciously, I think speaks to Ellison's intentions here, to say that, you know, a war can go on so long that if you don't really keep clear what you're fighting for, there really does become no difference between you and the other guy.
Yeah, it's, I mean, as you said already, that certainly within the context of the time the episode was made, I mean, you had a lot of writers obviously looking at communism as being this new foe. It was this idea of the military-industrial complex, like, growing to fight this monstrous foe that really a lot of, especially with, like, America, there was this constant threat of the invasion by the communist forces. So it's not hard to see, obviously, his chain of thinking that the government would obviously invest all this time and effort into pushing forward and creating the military state, that we would end up in this environment where they are essentially just breeding soldiers in test tubes. Because obviously, what's better than a perfect soldier? The soldier that you can condition not to feel emotion and to just basically do as he's commanded.
Right. That's the perfect soldier right there.
Yeah.
And certainly that super soldier idea is another one, not necessarily the fighting machine, you know, the battle droid or the Terminator or whatever, just the person who's very much a person but completely and utterly bred for battle is another one you get time and time again, recurs over and over in science fiction.
Yeah. One of the aspects which I felt was a little, again, this is something that didn't really work, is that when he sees the cat and he's trying to communicate with his generals through the cat, and they tried to, this is even better though, that the fact that we've got the quotes, obviously they're talking to the cat, and then Keegan's like, oh, this must be how they communicate in his timeline.
There are some really, really, really nice leaps of logic that really, I mean, there's some just wonderful, how the hell could you possibly infer that from that? But yeah, I give that one a pass because it is so funny that the first time he sees the cat's running, you know, just looking at Quarlo and meowing and trilling, and Quarlo's just looking at him and saying, "Name Quarlo Cabretti Prime Power M-E-N-T-N-D-O," you know, like, because apparently, you know, Kagan figures, oh, in the future, in the future, this is, instead of having, like, I don't know, sophisticated con systems or something, like, they've even bred their pets. They've even bred, or I wouldn't necessarily say pets, but animals we would keep as pets, but yeah, even domesticated animals are bred, you know, so these sort of, like, almost like these telepathic, you know, these telepathic communication systems between, you know, the soldier and his commanding officer. I don't know, my own personal feeling would be, assumption would actually be that the commanding, that dogs and cats or whatever, cats had actually evolved to the point where they dominated humans, and it was these cats that were making people fight each other. kind of like the way they can, you know, to go back to the episode we did about Dogtooth.
True.
I was waiting for the cat with the hammer to show up.
Which I don't know if that's more illogical than a cat being used as a recording device, as seems to be implied in this episode.
But the thing is that they've definitely got comm systems in their helmets.
Yeah.
I mean, if that's the situation, then why don't they wear cats on their heads?
The only way I could see it is so that they would send the cat in and it would act as like a recording device and they bring the cat back and be able to get the recording, kind of like what the Hunger Jays did with the Mockingjay.
For some reason, I started just to think uncontrollably of Mission Impossible. This cat will self-destruct in 1 minute.
But then again, have you ever tried to get a cat to do anything? They're the most self-centered, very...
I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm a cat person. I've got a cat of my own. He does not do what he's told. These are like, the sort of animals that you kind of get in wars are like dogs and horses and birds, you know? Animals that train well. Cats don't train well. You know, it's like, cat, commanding, go back and tell my cat, give this message to commanding officer. The cat's just going to like wander off and, I don't know, chase a bird or something, and the message will never get there. You know, and it's just like, it's funny. I mean, it's hilarious. The cat's just like, meow, meow, meow. But it's like, it is one of those things that it's not a very successful, I guess, development of the future world.
Yeah, it's an idea that perhaps sounded good at the time, but certainly doesn't hold up when you start to question it more.
Yeah.
I mean, I just want to obviously, because you mentioned already that this episode was part of a larger legal issue with the Terminator.
Uh-huh.
And the interesting part is the fact that Harlan actually said that if Cameron had asked if he could use the story, he would have happily given it to him. The fact that Cameron just basically took what he wanted and went off and did his own thing.
Uh-huh.
And then basically blocked him for a number of different avenues was the reason it ended up being... having to be settled out of court. And I mean, this went into the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
That this little short story cost Cameron as a result of it.
Uh-huh.
All he needed to do was just, you know, ask permission, and he would have given it to him.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is the thing with Cameron, is that I don't want to say he's an egotistical filmmaker, but he certainly has his own way of going about things.
Oh, I do want to say he's an egotistical filmmaker. I mean, that's not a damnation of his character as a human being. I mean, in order to be like a visionary of the rank that he's been, and I mean, even the films that I don't care for that he's done, he's still someone who has a vision in his head and has the capability of drawing everything in and realizing that film, realizing that onto film, that requires a certain amount of ego.
Yes. But certainly, as I said, certainly when you look at certain shots in this episode and ideas, I feel it's more sort of Demon with a Glass Hand that sort of plays more into the main themes of Terminator, but certainly you can see the elements that were borrowed, should we say, from Sojourn that were obviously carried across to the Terminator.
Uh-huh.
It's surprising, really, that when we look to when the series was rebooted back in 1995 and through to 2002, there was no episode that tried to remake Sojourn. There was other episodes where they revamped them, such as iRobot, and there's a couple of other ones in there, but for some reason Soldier never got remade. It just remained this obscure episode, I would say, in many ways. Unless you're really a fan of The Outer Limits, it's not the episode that really gets brought up much, which is kind of a shame.
It's The Outer Limits, I think, is one of those, and it is like the true cult show. It is a show that most people, I think, have heard of, but it doesn't seem to... I don't remember... In terms of cult shows, it's almost gone, you know, the opposite route, where it people don't seem to talk about it as much as they, you know, as they used to. You know, it's been eclipsed by other things.
Yeah.
It is one of the things I have noticed is that you take a look at the big iconic episodes, and I don't know to what extent you want to say Soldier is iconic, but it is, you know, one of Harlan Ellison's episodes, and it is, you know, one of the ones that people tend to remember what it was, if they, you know, what its significance was, even if they actually haven't seen it, along with Demon with a Glass Hand. The other really iconic, beyond those two, the other real iconic episode of The Outer Limits, I can't remember, Architects of Fear, which was also borrowed later. It was much of the later subplots of the graphic novel Watchmen are inspired by Architects of Fear, even to the point where at the end of the final issue, Alan Moore even puts an explicit shout out there. I don't think the rebooted series did a remake of Architects of Fear either.
No, there was a number of episodes that they missed off. Certainly, the reboot series featured really one of the scariest episodes of any show, and it's an episode that still haunts me now, which was the third episode of the first season, Boogeyman. For myself, it's probably one of the most effective episodes of the whole of that reboot thing. And certainly, when they rebooted the show, it changed a lot of ways of how sex is portrayed on TV, really pushed a lot of the boundaries for censorship, and was an effective reboot. And it kind of makes me miss, in a way, the fact that we don't have an anthology show at the moment. We don't have like another Outer Limits or a Twilight Zone, or even a Tales from the Crypt.
Right. Darknet. If Darknet takes off a little bit more, it might, I think, take the place of a sort of a Tales from the Crypt. The closest thing I think we have to anything like that is, say, Black Mirror.
Yeah. Black Mirror is, again, it really reminds me a lot of the Outer Limits, even though it's more technology-based with its theming. Certainly, Black Mirror has that standalone anthology feel.
Uh-huh.
I feel that the fact that each of the seasons are so short, there are only three stories per season, that it stops it being really seen as being this anthology series.
Right.
That it truly needs to be seen as, really.
It's almost like, it's kind of, because, I mean, it's been going on. Charlie Brooker's been doing it since, I think, 2011 or 2012, and yet there are only 7 episodes of Black Mirror. And it's really one of those things where I think we tend to look at it less as a series and look at it more the way I think people will look in hindsight at Masters of Horror, which is less of an anthology series and just kind of like an umbrella title for a bunch of short films.
Yeah.
You know, which is, you look straight at it, there may not be all that much of a difference, but there is a subtle difference in how it's thought of. There's simply, you know, at this point, I don't know how it's regarded in Britain, but over here it's only really starting to kind of catch on. And because there are so few episodes, even to the point where we're doing the typical American thing and we've bought it and we're doing a remake for American TV. And Robert Downey Jr. optioned one of the episodes for a feature film.
Okay. I'm not sure these episodes really work, expanded it past the sort of 45-minute sort of run times. I feel that they work in the self-contained form.
Right.
Certainly, it was a sleeper hit. It was only once the second season came out that a lot of people started talking more about the show, and by the time we had the Christmas special, that it sort of really sort of instilled itself as a sort of proper cult hit. But same when that first season was released, very few people were talking about it. I think even less people would have been talking about it had Charlie Brooker not been involved.
Right.
Obviously, he had done his zombie take on the Big Brother house.
Dead set.
Which,
oh yeah, dead set.
It's essentially set the tone. That was like the test run for Black Mirror. Obviously, Black Mirror goes off and it's more, as we said already, goes more technology sort of based. But it's, for my money, certainly one of the smarter shows. Each episode has always got a really good twist. The themes that he's choosing to explore and the ideas that he's doing with each episode are certainly really interesting stories.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're standalone means that you can sort of dip in and out. You don't have to think, oh, I've got to watch all these other episodes first to know what's going on. Because as I said, each episode, it's a brand new story.
Right. And it's definitely, you know, even though it's definitely modern, it's gone, and it's not just the anthology format. It's also the fact that it's using science fiction tropes and using the science fiction format not as a sort of, you know, pretext for action or explosions or anything like that. Not that I'm putting any of that down, you know, because entertainment is definitely important. But that it's using, the thing I really like about Black Mirror is how it uses the science fiction format to explore, you know, concepts, to kind of like a social commentary, really.
Yeah. Oh, so, and I mean, has there been a personal favorite episode for yourself so far?
The ones that really have stuck with me, the second episode, I think it's called 5 Million Merits.
Yep.
The one with the reality show. That one really got me. The one Be Right Back really got me. And the one, even though I don't think it's one of the strongest ones, I think it's only maybe about middling on my list of when I rank the episodes in quality, but the middle episode of the second series, White Bear, with when it comes out with its when it's revelation, I literally had to pause the stream and just sit there with my jaw open for about 5 minutes.
White Bear for myself has been the highlight of the show so far. Certainly the Christmas special brought in some interesting ideas, and that was interesting again is the fact that for the special they essentially crammed a whole season into an hour and a half.
Right.
They did 3 stories back to back, which I thought was a nice take rather than just doing one long story. So.
And it also gets that sort of parallel with Christmas Carol going,
yeah.
Which I thought was kind of neat.
It's it really says a lot about us Brits when we produce a Christmas special that dark.
Oh yes, but it's definitely. And the other really thing I like about Black Mirror is how it will use familiar to me actors, like White Bear, for example. Michael Smiley, who I primarily know as kind of like, even when he's not playing comedic, he's playing something of a sarcastic character. And for him to play that particular character just so darkly was just like, whoa. And Tuppence Middleton, actually, as well, whom I kind of saw as, okay, she's a pretty face. She's done a couple movies I saw. She's a pretty face, but I, you know, she doesn't really seem to have a whole lot of depth as an actress. And then I saw her in this, and I'm just like, ugh. You know, it's just kind of using, like, your preconception, or at least I don't know if that's deliberate on the part of the producers and of Charlie Brooker, but it's like, I'm sort of like, that really kind of plays in, like, my preconceptions of what something's going to be like.
I think if there's, is there anything else that we've really got to discuss on Soja now?
There is one last thing that I want to mention about Soldier, and as with a couple of other things we've mentioned, this is actually something that's a little bit more prevalent in Demon with a Glass Hand, which has a different director. But the other thing that I kind of wanted to mention about Soldier and Outer Limits as a whole is the direction of the series as a whole, but this particular one, a lot of the directors that they used on The Outer Limits were German directors or European directors American directors who were influenced by German directors. And this is particularly... Did you watch or rewatch Demon with a Glass Hand for the recently?
I haven't revisited Demon with Glass Hand recently. I just obviously, when you look at Soldier and obviously you see the controversy surrounding it, that it obviously instantly brings to mind, whoa, Demon with Glass Hand surely would have been the one that they should have got most upset about.
Right.
Obviously Soldier was the one that they decided to press ahead and do the charges for.
Visually, and the reason I'm bringing up the nationality of the directors is because German directors, particularly a lot of them coming out of the Expressionist movement, invented film noir. And in particular, the director of Soldier, Gerd Oswald, actually directed one of the classic archetypal films noir, Kiss Before Dying. And again, this is something that you see probably a lot more in Demon with a Glass Hand, which... I was actually surprised to go back to the other to the Mad Bad episode that you and I recorded. I was actually thinking how much Demon with a Glass Hand reminded me of Dark City in a way.
Okay.
And indeed, the locations in that episode, many of the scenes, later scenes in Blade Runner, were shot in the same locations. But there is definitely a cross, and this is one of the things that makes Outer Limits really stand out to me, is the definite noir influence that shows in the episodes. And this, like I said, it isn't as prevalent in Soldier, but it is there. It's definitely got a bit of a noir/expressionistic, particularly in the futuristic scenes. When I called it a futuristic wasteland from a Germanist expressionist film, I wasn't being entirely facetious. But it is something that, you know, these are directors who really know how to use black and white and contrasting between light and shadow.
As with Ultra Q, the fact it is the episode shot in black and white, it looks so much better than if it was shot in color. I could see this episode really losing a lot if it had been shot in color. But at the same time, the laser effects, I love the old school effects when it comes to things such as the laser effects that we see in the episode, be it the ones fired from their guns or the ones coming randomly out of the sky. I don't know what the effect style is called, but I would, instead of doing so much CG, I would love to see more of that style of effect being used.
Yeah, the one that really struck me, and the zap, the laser beams, the energy beams, the one coming out of the sky was definitely a highlight. The one that I thought was I really enjoyed was towards the end, where the other soldier, the enemy soldier, basically uses his laser to like cut a hole in the side of the house.
It's not so much a hole, but he just takes out the whole wall.
He just takes out the wall, but it's I just love effects like that.
Yeah, when they actually do that, the burn, so the big entrance of the second soldier, you can pretty much see where they've marked out for the burn to go. Especially as it hits the corner, you can see, oh, he's going to form this perfect square. It's not going to inflame and take out the rest of the city. Uh-huh. It's quite a big burn that they do for essentially what he's supposed to be like a very small door he's carving, but here he just takes out a whole wall.
You know, and it works for me. It's not the most realistic thing, but I don't know. For me, a lot of the time when it comes to a lot of these older style practical effects, I care in many ways not so much whether they're realistic, but whether they look nice. You know, it's there's just certain things, and this is not really highlighted. This is not the episode of The Outer Limits for that. Demon with the Last Hand has some really good effects. A season one episode that I am very fond of, it came out of the woodwork, has this great sort of quasi-lost smoke monster. And just the way that they go, they flash from positive, negative, desaturating the picture. It's a thing of beauty. It actually really kind of reminded me of the old 60s and 70s Dalek extermination effect. Before they started doing the whole CGI skeleton. Ooh, you can see the skeleton bit.
It's with the whole new Dalek effect thing. As you said, the whole skeleton zapping effect that they do now doesn't really work, and I hated the fact that they made this big deal about all these Daleks can fly, and I'm thinking, well, you have the Sylvester McCoy episode where he's at the top of the stairs and he thinks he's beating the Dalek only for it to then slowly float up the stairs. That was effective. They didn't need to fly around randomly for the sky to be effective.
That was just something that's like, yeah, that was a surprise. And I remember seeing it in the very first episode that they had Daleks in the new show. And I remember actually saying, and that will surprise. Well, it will surprise, you know, the 16 years worth of people who were born since, you know, Remembrance of the Daleks was broadcast and haven't seen that story.
Yeah, I mean, is there anything else you want to bring up with Soldier before we wrap it up?
That is all I have to say about Soldier.
Okay. And with that, it brings us to the end of this premiere episode of TV Good, Sleep Bad. Looking ahead to the next episode, Lucky, what are you bringing to the table?
I am bringing an episode of one of my favorite sketch comedy shows, of the 90s, the appropriately named Mr. Show with Bob and David. Bob and David being, of course, Bob Odenkirk, now best known as Saul Goodman from Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, and David being David Cross of Arrested Development and the increasingly poor decisions of Todd Margaret. The fifth episode of Season 3, Please Don't Kill Me, features some of my favorite sketches of the series, including the landlord sketch, the Evil Geniuses telethon, and Mustard A&A's.
Cool. It's a show that never made it over to the UK, or if it did, it's one that I completely missed. So it's going to be interesting, because obviously I'm familiar with his with the work that they've obviously gone on to do. Obviously Arrested Development, another show, which firm favorite of mine, and I really always loved the loved it when he was playing the Never Nude. So I'm very keen to obviously see what he brings to the Mr. Show, because obviously it's got this legacy. It's a show that's constantly brought up, so I'm looking forward to obviously my first experience
and it's,
there.
It's not just them. This was actually a really formative early show, important early show for a lot of people in the American comedy scene that made really key early performances. I'm not 100% sure who's in this episode, but Jack Black did Mr. Show, Sarah Silverman. I am pretty sure Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob, is in this. A couple of other people. This is kind of like a really kind of like seminal show in kind of like in the history of American sketch comedy. Between this and the other one that's really remembered from the mid-90s is The State, which plenty of people from The State have gone on to do various things like Wet Hot American Summer.
Another show that I've yet to watch on Netflix, so I keep hearing it's good. So
yeah.
I don't know whether to watch the film first and then the series, but no one
seems
to
be that I don't know.
Answer. For myself, I'm going to be throwing you the first collection of Dick Spanner stories. For those not familiar, Dick Spanner was a show created in 1986. It was originally shown as 6-minute episodes, and this episode we're going to look at is The Case of the Human Cannonball, so we're going to take all those episodes and look at it as one whole piece. For those not familiar with Dick Spanner, it's a show created by Jerry Anderson, who's probably best known for creating the likes of Thunderbirds, Stingray, and Captain Scarlet. This was one of his little side projects, the same way that he did Space Precinct. This was one of the early ones. It's a stop-motion animation, and it's a film noir as shot through the lens of the Naked Gun. And it stars a robot private detective named Dick Spanner. And it's going to be interesting to see how this one holds up, because I remember loving this one as a kid. Looking at the few clips I've seen, it's safe to say the animation hasn't aged as well as I probably have played it in my mind. So, you know, there's the heavy power of nostalgia goggles warning ahead for this one. But it's going to be interesting to obviously see what you make of this one. If you obviously want to watch the show ahead of our episode, you can find the episodes on YouTube. There's an actual official channel there, so it's not going to be taken down before you get halfway through the series. So certainly you should check it out.
I am definitely looking forward to Dick Spanner. I am woefully undereducated when it comes to Jerry Anderson. I've never seen any of his stop motion or Super Marionation stuff. The only Jerry Anderson stuff I've seen is I have caught the entirety of UFO.
I believe we're going to be looking at some episodes on future episodes of the show.
We will.
Which is it's going to be exciting, because again, that was his first, and I think, well, apart from Space Precinct, it was one of the few rare cases where he was doing marionette work in case of the models and with actual human actors. So yeah, it'd be certainly interesting to finally revisit another piece of my childhood, which I'm feeling the show's really going to descend into us, just looking back at nostalgically at things from our childhood.
Yeah,
many a misspin tower finally being put to good use.
If only I knew when I was a kid that all those sleepless nights spent up all night watching Doctor Who and British crime dramas and episodes of the Twilight Zone would be eventually put to good use. Don't worry, Mom and Dad. In 30 years, I'll figure out something useful to do with this.
As for the show itself, we are currently aiming to get a new episode out really on a monthly basis. Just this really just due to the amount of, obviously, the projects that we've got. I obviously have the Madman Downright Strange Showcase, which you can find on both Podomatic and iTunes, as well as my main site, From the Depths DVD Hell. As for my co-host, Lackey, what other projects you got currently happening at the moment?
Well, I have my dedicated site, the NightmareGallery.com, where I review movies, chiefly horror, but also going into many different other genres, and television, where I am currently reviewing the third season of Hannibal. I also do a monthly movie review for Cinema Axis at cinemaaxis.com. And you can find me on various other sites, occasionally contributing guest stuff. And I'll be, you mentioned channel Superheroes Tales from the Crypt blogathon. I will be reviewing at least one episode. The final episode, an animated episode, I believe directed by Bobcat Goldthwait. chew on that one for a little. Interestingly enough, they must have done the final season of that show in Britain. They must have filmed it in Britain because, like, the entire final season of Tales from the Crypt has, like, people like Daniel Craig and Steve Coogan in it.
The thing with Tales from the Crypt, it never seemed to have, like, a mainstream presence. It was kind of like a late-night TV fodder, so I kind of missed out on it. So that's another reason I'm very excited to have the opportunity now to go back and revisit some of these episodes. Certainly for the blog fun, I will be looking at the episode The Pit, which does feature Mr. Mark Dacos.
Dacos.
Who, one of those kung fu artists like Michael J. White, who really never gets the props he deserves. He's been in noteworthy films, but martial artists, he's certainly worth a chew.
We don't know him for any of that stuff over here.
Okay.
In America, he is... His signature role in America is he is the chairman on Iron Chef America.
He was also in Brotherhood of the Wolf, France's only kung fu movie.
That I didn't know.
He plays Manny the Inuit.
I mean, I see him on the, you know, occasional thing here and there. I know he was, I remember seeing him on a couple episodes of the Hawaii Five-O revival.
Yeah.
And I remember back in the early 2000s, a friend of mine had an obsession with the Crow TV show, and I remember he was on that. But no, over here he's the chairman for Iron Chef America.
You learn something new every day.
Yeah.
As I say, if you want to leave us some feedback, we do appreciate any feedback, either in the comment section below, or you can hit us up on the Facebook page. Just type in TV Good, Sleep Bad, and the page will come up. And you can obviously follow us there. Also, make sure you hit the subscribe button with the, obviously, this being a monthly show. We don't want you to obviously miss out on any episodes and obviously get them sent directly to your preferred device. So hit the subscribe button now and make sure you never miss a show. But if there's an episode of a obscure or cult show you would like to see covered on the show, also let us know, either on the Facebook page or the comment section, and we can try and get it worked into a future episode as well. But until next time, I'd just like to obviously say thank you for my co-host, my co-pilot into the realm of the cult and obscure, Mr. Lackey.
Oh, God, if I'm your co-pilot, you are in deep, deep shit.
Obviously, this is Edward Jones signing off the premiere episode of TV Good, Sleep Bad. Thank you all again for listening, and see you next time.
Thank you.